When you're ready to ride Metro, we want you to know we're ready for you. Here are just a few of the people at Metro to tell you how we're doing our part to keep riders safe.
We're cleaning like never before, with hospital-grade cleaning.
You'll find hand sanitizer stations all over the Metro.
No mask, no Metro. Need one? We have a few extras.
At Metro, we're doing our part to keep the D.C. area moving. Find out more at WMATA.com/doingourpart.
Welcome to Comfortably Uncomfortable Conversations. My guest today is my friend Wally. I'm really excited because you're one of my favorite Twitter users. How are you?
I'm doing well, mostly.
Mostly. So you're in Seattle?
Yes, ma'am.
The home of?
Coffee and beer.
Oh. And Kurt Cobain.
Oh, and Kurt Cobain. And
which is more exciting to me than it is to you.
I like Kurt Cobain.
I don't know how you can't not like Kurt Cobain.
I know, right?
So we talk a lot about mental health. That's something that you focus a lot on. You were a soldier. Can you talk a little bit about how your experiences have affected your mental health?
Oh, boy. So my PTSD counselor and I have talked about this a lot. I had PTSD, like he said, the interior stats on the VA hospital, about 50% of the people going into the military have PTSD when they enter. And they are committed to treating all of those people. But, you know, if you came into it with PTSD, then you don't obviously get benefits for, you know, money or anything for that. But they will give you medical. So I came from an abusive childhood and I was masking all of my symptoms and stuff so I could fit in and do my job. I was the classic overachiever. And I was in for 12 years. Lots of bodies, you know, we did lots of search and rescue. So just lots of bodies in every state, you know, from mangled and pulled into the back of a fishing trawler to on a cruise ship, you know, having congestive heart failure. But honestly, the hardest ones for me were the children. We would get called on a medevac to get some small girl, you know, say in Angoon, and get her back, and they would pronounce her dead on the runway because she had bacterial meningitis. And, you know, those things just stick with you forever. Those things stick with you forever.
Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah. Overall, you know, the VA has treated me really well in the last 12 years. They've come a long way in the last 24 years, from the dark ages to almost the 20th century now. So
being a veteran, when you hear Donald Trump utilizing vets for his own gain, how does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, this is the guy who's supposed to be the leadership. He's the headmostest civilian military leader. He's supposed to be there for us. We're not supposed to be there for him. That's not the way military leadership works. Military leadership is there so that we can get the job done and they clear the hurdles. And instead, you know, he's just become this great big huge hurdle, both emotionally, psychologically. And I mean, his rhetoric is just insane. He doesn't know a single thing about us. Not one.
What would you say to him if you could sit down and talk with the president and have a conversation as a vet and as a man who is openly gay, who has mental health issues, who's dealing with those issues? What would the first thing you say to him be?
I mean, the first thing I would say is the thing that he's never going to understand. And that's, you know, learn to listen. I mean, it's the same thing the white community needs to learn, you know, learn how to listen. We have our worldview. He has his worldview. And not a lot of listening takes place where we just sit down and we close our mouths and we open our eyes and our ears and our heart and our mind and we put ourselves in their shoes and we listen. And I mean, in the United States, really, that's the biggest hurdle to any discussion happening in the United States right now is people just don't know how to listen or they won't do it. So that's my message to him.
When George Floyd was killed, And I talked about this in my last podcast with Vestia. A lot of white people came to me and they were like, I'm sorry, and what can I do? And on and on and on. And then it sort of, I noticed a rapid decline. It was like, are you really here as an ally, or are you here because you just want that murder porn? Do you ever feel that when you're going through something where people are like, we're here in the moment, but we're not necessarily here for the extended process?
Well, I mean, you know how American media has kind of infiltrated the entire world and shortened everybody's attention spans. Everything is tic-tac sized, and it just gets a little ridiculous on that end. I think all the good white people that I know, they don't know what to do or say. They're kind of floored by all of this. Some of them have seen it coming, but most of them, I think, are just kind of like, you know, when they see somebody suffering and they, you know, I saw the Black community suffering, and I'm like, I immediately set out to find ways through. And I mean, you know, saying sorry is nice and all, but it doesn't do anything. And so I tried to set about changing behaviors and mentalities, but I was amazed at how many people would not take up that conversation. Those comments and things that I created online are still mostly empty. My close followers, they were right there. They were with me. You know, we're all pretty much on the same page, but like the rest of America, it's very, very strange. I would liken it exactly to a dysfunctional family.
Yeah. I agree. So
did I answer your question?
Yes. Okay. I know that things in Seattle right now are really crazy because I have a lot of friends around the world and they're keeping me in the know. But as far as what's happening in America from the media, like, we're not really hearing about the protests and the rioting and the Antifa and all of that. What's it like in Seattle right now for you guys living there?
You know, honestly, Seattle has always been a city that could deal with a scrap. So Seattle has always been a city that could deal with a scrap. I mean, I think we were one of the first cities that any president ever called the National Guard out on for a riot. I think it was the Longshoremen back in the 1800s. And this city has always been pretty tough and gritty. And, you know, we're really just going about our lives. Everybody really is just doing the best they can to get along. I've even talked to several of my friends, you know, when I go out, like to the grocery store, because I mean, anymore, the biggest social gatherings any of us have are at the grocery store. And a lot of us try to time our event so that we're there and we can actually talk.
One sec. An obnoxiously annoying rude neighbor just drove by in his V8.
Yeah.
Do you guys time your grocery store escapades together?
Yeah. Try to
That's
make
really
it
cool.
Because, I mean, it's hard to have any real FaceTime. And, I mean, this is like my third time on Zoom ever in my life. I'm a computer geek from 78-ish, but I'm like, Zoom? I'm like, oh, shit, it crashed on me twice today. I'm like, but, you know, honestly, there's a process in Seattle that involves confrontation, cogitation, and then writing. And people here are very smart. Like one of the more educated cities in the United States. I think we're in the top three typically as far as people with degrees. And there are some rightfully upset people, and they get together on these things. They created a safe space to work on it. They created documents. And I trust the Seattle process to spit out, you know, both good ideas and bad ideas. But, you know, the city then gets those ideas and then it's up to them to act, and then we vote on it. And the Seattle process, the Seattle way, is kind of confusing, I think, to the rest of the country. After the WTO, you know, I realized the rest of the country has no idea what it's like here. You know, yes, we're this beautiful, pristine little city, but you know what? We've got gritty underbelly, and we're used to having to fight for what we need. And I mean, other people just think, oh, it's just Libtard Central. I'm like, well, you know, I think 40% of the population here is conservative.
Wow.
It's Pugetopolis, you know, it's 4 million people. I think it's an accurate representation, you know, but I mean, the Seattle process is such that, yeah, you scrap it out, then you think about it, and then you talk about it, and then you write about it. And you get it out there, and outreach and education has been big. And I've noticed a lot of people on the Seattle boards that I read frequently are still talking about this, trying to get our mayor to listen. And I don't think that she's going to do that, unfortunately. She's a business person, and this is what happens when you get business people in positions of power.
Yeah. When you hear the phrase Black Lives Matter, what does that say to you?
It makes me want to cry.
Okay, well, you can't start crying, because if you cry, I'm going to cry, and it's just,
okay,
we're just not going to stop.
not crying. That we even have to say it at all is an indictment of our entire society. And that anybody would ever question it or come out with an alternative way, you know, all lives matter, is an indictment on our society. It just points to the things that are broken. The things that people won't talk about are the things that need to be talked about the most. So when I hear Black Lives Matter, my heart swells with pride, because every person of color and every Black person that I know has come so far against so many incredible odds. I'm just with them, and I'm here. If anybody calls, if anybody needs help, if anybody needs first aid after a protest, I'm here. And people have my name and my number and my address, and they can show up, and I'll help out however I can. You know, being disabled makes me feel a lot less capable to help out, but I can do all sorts of other things, and I still have a great brain. But Black Lives Matter is about justice. And if there's justice for Black lives, then there's justice for all lives. And I think people need to get off their fucking asses and do something about this. I'm just beside myself that we can't wrap our heads around the fact that if Black people have justice, then everybody has justice. If Black people don't have justice, then there's not real justice at all. And I don't know why people can't wrap their heads around that. I made a meme the other day with a mosquito on it, and I said, it says all lives matter, you know, mosquito sucking blood out of somebody. I'm like, cause that's what they're saying. You know, I don't understand the mindset that is going to classify things like that. It's like, you know what? No, Black lives matter. They fucking matter.
So not too long ago, I think like 3 days, and thank you for saying that. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think 3 days ago, somebody posted on Twitter that people who are not in the LGBTQ+2 community, God, that anagram is getting longer and longer every year. The people that are not in our community shouldn't be hoisting up the pride flag. And I don't agree with that statement. I think that it is, just from my perspective, it's a way of saying, I am here for you. I trust you. I welcome you into my home if you need a safe place to be. It's a calling card to let us know that we have a safe space. What do you think about that?
The pride flag was originally meant to be all inclusive. I mean, it's for everybody. I mean, every color, it's supposedly for everybody. And I'm probably a little old school on this. I'm 56 years old. I'm a little old school on this. I'm a Wookiee sanitation commando at a gay bar up on Capitol Hill. And it's like, it's a bar that's safe and open for everybody. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight. And I think if somebody wants to fly a pride flag, I mean, why would I ever be upset about more exposure? Part of that pride flag is being counted, you know, as somebody who supports, as somebody who is gay. I'm for anybody who wants to fly the pride flag. I mean, I can't imagine not being for that.
I think for me personally, like, and I've been thinking a lot about this, I think sexuality is so fluid and gender identity is so fluid that I think everybody has a little bit of LGBTQ+2 in them. And I think that saying to people, you can't hoist the flag because you're not out and proud of your sexuality, you don't talk about it, is so exclusive and so contrary to what the pride flag stands for.
Well, I'm with you on that. I have this view of sexuality as being a continuum or a spectrum, with like the gayest of the gay on one side and the straightest of the straight on the other. And then in the middle, every mix of everything that you could possibly imagine. And I'm like, being gay a while back was about, you know, being sex positive, you know, no judgment for your sexual needs or whatever. And it's kind of weird in the straight community, it gets a little judgmental, but I've noticed now, like, there's this weird fragmentation that's happening. Like, it's what you're talking about. You know, you can't fly the flag. It's like, well, then what do you want me to think about you? You know, I mean, is this, it's not some exclusive club. I mean, we're just part of humanity.
I think that's it exactly. I feel like if we want to continue fighting for inclusivity, we can't then exclude people because they're not. And I want to say out, because some people are married with, you know, straight sex partners and they have kids, and secretly they have those desires or those urges or those needs that are not being met. When I worked in the sex store, I met a man way older than you, like in his 70s or 80s or close to death, he looked. And I remember him saying to me, I come here for the transgender magazines because nobody knows that I'm out. And he's had a wife. He's got 5 kids. I will never forget this. He has been married for most of his life and nobody knew that he was into this part of his life. And I thought that was so sad, because how do you go 80 years without saying, this is who I am in my entirety? It's because people have told you, you cannot be included.
Right. And I have two handfuls of transgendered friends who know me and know my actual story. And I've only let this out like 3 times, maybe. But I've had this thing every day. I wake up and I'm like, where are my girl parts? And it's really the hardest thing, you know. Since I was little, I'd wake up in a panic. It's like, what is that between my legs? Where are my parts? And, I grew up in Montana in the 60s, 70s, and part of the 80s. And there was just nothing. And I had no understanding. And I just went on my way as best I could. And then, you know, as I got older, I realized, oh, shit, you know, my brain is a lot more feminized than the average gay guy's brain. And now I get it. I'm like, but, you know, I've made my life and I'm okay. But I've been amazed at the number of transgendered folk, and it's very similar to the flag. It's like, well, I haven't transitioned, or I haven't done this, I haven't done that, so I'm not one of them. And I've just ended up pulling back. I support them as people, but I don't always support the way that they do things. The manner with which is important, I think. It's the parallel that I'll draw to the flag. The first splinter in any group always begets more splinters, and it just creates factionalism. And now, you know, everybody's so specialized that there is no more gay community. There's a couple kernels of gay community that interact and stuff. And, you know, this is where gay bars still play a part, you know, like the place where I work. It's CC's here in Seattle. And, you know, they're adamant. This is for everybody. It doesn't, gay, straight, we don't care. You just have to be nice to people. And honestly, I mean, that's the best way to network. That's the best way to have a coalition of supporters. That's, you know, it's the best way to fight factionalism. It's like, you know what, we are all in this boat together in spite of our specialty sexuality. So I might be rambling.
No, I was just thinking, when I was 16, I knew a young kid who I will never for the life of me. Oh my God. We were walking up the stairs. I was putting her to bed. And I say her, because at the time they were her. She was about 6 years old. And she said, I think when I grow up, I want to be a boy. And I was 16 and I was like, how do I quantify that? What do I say to that? And I thought, all right, what do you want your name to be? And they told me, And I thought, okay, well, then one day you will be. And now they are. She has become he. Oh, and I couldn't be more proud of this young person who, at that young an age, knew who they were, knew who they wanted to be, and have worked to get there. And they have had to deal with some of the most heinous,
it's so and awful.
Awful forms of abuse.
Yeah, it's
and
so
yet
awful.
They still found themselves.
That's cool. I mean, finding yourself, even if you're in a volcano of hate, you know, I mean, it's really powerful. And this just, you know, I have this viewpoint, you know, other people's gender is none of my damn business. If they choose to confide in me, I'm honored. But I mean, it's not something I'm going to let slip. It's not, I mean, I hold that in confidence. I think pronouns are kind of silly. They're, you know, they're from the, what, 1500s. And it's kind of the first splinter, the faction, you know, we'll split them into he and she. It's like, you know what, honestly, it's us. And somebody's gender is none of my business. So they confide in me. That's great. I will hold it in confidence. I will love them dearly. And I will consider that a very big act of trust if they do that. But honestly, this country is so lost. You know, you can't live and let live is just gone. It's been obliterated.
So. What advice do you have for young gay men who are listening to this podcast and thinking, I understand that. I understand that struggle, but I don't know how to get from point A, where I recognize where I am, to point B, and I am where I want to be.
You know, honestly, it's the same route that so many of us have taken over the years. Gay men were the first ones to figure out with a modem and a bulletin board service, we could actually find each other and talk to each other. And my advice is to find each other and to talk to each other. And it's hard to know who you are or what you like or what you're all about until you start vocalizing it. It becomes more real the more words you put out. Honestly, there are a lot of us out there who will mentor people. I have no interest in anything other than helping people be happy with their own lives. This is such a difficult subject because, I mean, a kid in Montana, a kid in Nebraska, I'm like, they really have to be careful. They're going to be subject to all sorts of things that the rest of the big cities, you know, we just don't have that kind of thing here in the numbers that you do in the Midwest or say in the Rockies. And I would, you know, use your computer, use encryption, find little bits and pieces of your tribe where you can where you can be safe and you can talk about things because you're going to have questions. And, you know, there's lots of different answers. There's not just one or five answers. There's lots of different answers. And you're going to want to weigh that and figure out which way you want to go in life. I won't tell them which way to go in life, but I think reaching out online is still the safest bet for most gay kids. And if they can make use of encryption, then they should make use of encryption.
So I've been asking all my American friends this because I know I'm excited and I've talked about this before and I will continue talking about this. Kamala Harris looks like me. She's Jamaican like me. Given the number of children that my birth father has, we're probably cousins. And I mean that genuinely. There's a good chance that we're related. How do you feel about Joe Biden choosing Kamala Harris?
Being the socialist anarchist that I am, I was not happy about Joe Biden. I just won't go into it. I'm just not happy with
him. Oh, no, by all means, please do. Let's talk about that. Because Joe is not the ideal campaign.
He is a neoliberal hack. He's about guarding the markets and the flow of money amongst the rich. And, you know, and to him, protecting the economy means protecting the businesses. And he's forgotten, like Soylent Green, the economy is people. You know, the economy is all people. Without people, there is no economy. But somehow, you know, people in his echelon stratum, whatever you want to call it, they tend to view the economy as something that starts around Wall Street. And I just don't see that. So when he chose Kamala Harris, she was my choice for president. And
she was our choice too.
So somebody's like, are you voting for Biden after all of this came out? I'm like, no, I'm voting for Kamala. So Biden is just the right or wrong as far as I'm concerned. And I'm so damn happy that she's his pick. I was like, please let it be Kamala. Please let it be Kamala.
I feel like there's a certain amount of, and I hate to be the girl that pops the balloon at the party, but I feel like there's a certain amount of knowing that Kamala Harris is popular. And I feel like that was the reason that she was chosen more than her skills or her talents or her abilities. That was who everybody wanted. Even if they didn't really want Kamala Harris, that's who they wanted.
She's a brilliant tactician, lawyer. Like, you know, she understands the law on a level that most people never, ever will. And she's quick on her feet. And she has the memory of seven elephants. And nobody's going to get anything up on her, which makes me feel better about the entire process. I mean, because, you know, American media is so sensationalized and factionalized, and it's just freaking ridiculous. But honestly, you know, people have said, oh, well, she's a cop. It's like, well, the indictment of cops, I was in the Coast Guard. I did law enforcement. That makes me a cop, too. And then suddenly I'm okay. They can make an excuse for me. I'm like, oh, isn't that cute? That's precious. And honestly, she's been an attorney for states. She's justice oriented. She's always been justice oriented. And she's a human being who can fess up to her fallibilities and make changes and move on. And I can't think of a better candidate in this climate right now than somebody who is an honest to goodness, accountable, ethical, concerned human being. I just can't think of a better candidate. And that, for me, that's Kamala. And hopefully she'll teach Biden something.
So Russell Brown came out last night, and he, I don't know if you saw the tweet, had some things to say about Cardi B's new song, WAP. For those of you, you don't know the song?
No.
So the song is called WAP, W-A-P, but it stands for Wet Ass Pussy. And he decided that he deserved to share his thoughts on female sexuality.
Oh my God.
And I thought, being that you are a gay man, you're the perfect man to ask, is there room in feminism for men to comment on female sexuality?
Not if they're not asked.
Look at that. It's such a simple answer.
Would I, as any man, accept anybody else's comments on my sexuality? Hell no. Never. If I asked, I might. I'll listen to it at least and be polite or tell them to fuck off. But not if they're not asked. If a woman asks a man what he thinks about sexuality for women and this and that, why would any woman ever do that?
I mean, no. I'm not saying it's something we think about very often.
Well, I've seen it happen, you know, and I've seen this come up. I've seen this come up on Twitter a lot. And I'm like, really? It's like sending a dick pic. What were you thinking? This isn't even your place, you know? I know a fair amount of women's sexuality, and I'm like, not going to come out unless I'm asked. And then I'm going to be very, very careful.
To that end, is there room for men in feminism?
You know, feminism is one of those movements like the gay movement. It's complex, and it's always been judged by straight men. And I think that men can be allies, but I think self-identifying as an ally is really poor taste. I will never identify as anybody's ally. That somebody can say, oh yeah, well, you're a great ally. I'm like, well, thank you. You know, compliments are difficult. Thank you. But am I going to actually say, oh, I'm your ally? And it's like, no, it's freaking pretentious. And I think that there is room for men around feminism, but feminism itself, that's lady talk. And I'm going to leave that to the ladies. I won't allow anybody to tell me what being gay is all about. And I don't think that the women in this world should ever let any man get in the middle of them. It's just going to factionalize stuff, you know, one splinter and then more splinters. Does that sound?
No, I think that's right. I think that there's, and it's happened on my timeline quite a bit. It happens on Michelle Guido's timeline quite a bit. It definitely happened on Anne or Profane Feminist timeline, where they will start talking about something that has something to do with women and women's spaces and women feeling safe to share their stories. And then that's like a whole pack of guys.
Yeah. When you invade a space, safe space for women as a guy, you're the aggressor. I'm not going to do it. I'll like comments and stuff. And I've actually made what I thought was a supportive comment. And then I've gone back a few minutes later and said, no, delete. Not my place. You know, honestly, women deserve safe spaces. And that's why I think, you know, men have a place around feminism, but they don't have a place inside of it.
Why do you think guys have such a hard time? And like, I'm going to call it out. It's not even just straight guys. There are some gay guys out there too that kind of push their way into conversations that they don't belong in. Why do you think that the male gender as a whole has such an issue with women having spaces that are just ours? Not that you speak for every white man in the world, your perspective.
It's a fair question. And I think, you know, there's so much trauma and so much abuse for people in America. I can't speak for other countries. A lot of people don't like being disincluded. And in this country, there is this undercurrent of machismo that is sold through Christianity and other avenues. And they really do believe that it's their job to provide for and take care of and protect, and that they think those are all honorable characteristics of a man. And I mean, honestly, the most honorable characteristic of a man is to shut the fuck up and listen. Learn something. This pisses me off.
For the record, everybody, it pisses me off too, but because you're pissed off, I can be really calm and just enjoy your anger as opposed to getting like, angry myself.
Attack Wookiee strikes. Oh my God. Yeah. There is this undercurrent of the way men are raised in this country. And I imagine it's actually worse in Mexico, and I imagine it's slightly less worse in Canada, but it's still present. And, you know, the way a man should be, you know, to take care of his family and to take care of his wife. It's like, honestly, from a mental health model, it's everybody's main responsibility to take care of themselves and then others first. And so I look at these guys doing this and I'm like, oh, my God, you're just a hot mess. You know, you can't take care of anything. You know, anybody who gets in a relationship thinking they're going to take care of their little woman is not in a relationship with the woman. They're in a relationship with their ego. You know, that's kind of where I am with this. I think people, men in this country, you know, we have this overdeveloped sense of responsibility. Sometimes it's good, but, you know, when you inflict it on others, it's actually a form of abuse. You know, it's not a conversation we ever have in this country. But, you know, inflicting your views and your protection on others, it's like if I went to a Black Lives Matter and then tried to like say, no, you need to be safe and you need to do this and you need to do that. You know, oh, my God, I would become the abuser. I'd be the outside person trying to affect change for their agenda. And I don't understand it. You know,
how do you think men can come to a place of understanding? Because you like, and this is one of the reasons I wanted to interview you, because you are such a proponent of women's rights, and because you support those of us who have been abused online, you have a perspective as a white man that I just don't have, that I will never connect to. So how do you think other white men can come to that place of like, maybe it is me, maybe I do need to step back a little bit, maybe I do need to keep my mouth shut and listen and learn?
My first question is, why am I saying this? before I ever type it out, the idea pops into my head, I should say this. And yeah. It's like, why should I say this? Who am I saying this to? Who is this for? Is this to assuage something inside of me, you know, some sense of responsibility, or, you know, and 99.9 times out of 100 online, you know, because gosh, you know, I'm full of great advice. I have some really great advice, especially on upswings. Oh my God. And like 99.9% of the time I'll start to type and I'll look at it and I'm like, oh my God, look at me. I'm shooting on them. You know, I mean, that's the other question I ask. Am I shooting on them? You should do this. You should do that. You should, you know, I ran into this today. A woman, she's been having acid reflux. And this is something I deal with anxiety and pain. The more my stressors go up, I reach this low level point of anxiety that I might not notice the anxiety, but suddenly I have this hellish acid reflux. And basically I end up saying, you know, for me, you know, I notice this is like low level stress and I got to take a Tums. And the other thing is, you know, I ask myself, have I eaten? And that was how I addressed my, but you know, that took me two times. I try to be conscientious about what I say and stuff. It took me two times to get my wording right. And I think, you know, men are supposed to have all the answers in this country. So they'll just blurt it out. They won't ever second guess anything that they think or say. They're just going to blurt it out. And I'm like, you know what? Pull back, reread it. Who are you talking to? You know, and what problem are you solving? I mean, if somebody gave me this advice in this tone, would I take it? And if the answer is no, then delete. I delete it, you know.
I do that too. I have moments where I'll tweet something out and I'm like, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Or I'll get really stoned and I'll say something and the next day I'll look at my Twitter and I'll just go, oh, Devin, what were you thinking? Why? I remember, okay, so this is a funny story. Like 4 years ago, somebody contacted me and they're like, you're really good at getting people to do things. My cousin has cancer. Can we get Captain America to send her a video? So I spent 2 days sending Chris Evans goat pictures because the girl in question liked goats. And like 2 freaking days, he made the video. Nice. Don't get me wrong, he made the video. Nice. But I like have never felt comfortable tweeting him again.
Right.
Like I haven't tweeted him at all. Because I like, and I used to call him my future husband, and now I can't say that because it's just like, it's too weird. I spent 2 days doing this, and I know it was for a good cause.
Did you send him a thank you?
No.
Oh, do that.
I was like, done.
Done.
It'll be a funny story one day when I'm like on Charlamagne the God's radio show or something.
Right? Oh my God.
Yeah, but Twitter's a weird place because you find yourself doing things like that for random strangers because it's such an easy thing to do. It's so simple to just say, hey, can you do this?
Reaching out has never been easier in our society, our world society. And that's part of the trap. You know, you're talking earlier about some of these things, you know, men who, is there space for men who are to be feminists and, you know, what men think and do and why. I mean, reaching out has never been easier. It's instantaneous. And I'm like, I just, you know, a long time ago during the, Victorian era when everybody was super uptight and super repressed, they used to have to put a lot of thought into their words and they would couch things in ways so that sexual innuendo was always carried in a certain kind of way. It wasn't like super obvious. And I'm like, and I just think, you know, we've lost a lot of nuance in this society, the world society. People just say what's on their mind and press send. And it's like, really, you know, you should have read that 3 times. There should have been 2 questions you asked, you know, at least 2 questions, read it 3 times. And I mean, on upswings, I'm more inclined to press send. I'll be like, ah, fuck it. It's a great idea. Rah. And then the next day I'm like, I'm going to delete this and I'm going to apologize all day. But
so Michelle Guido and Profane both talked about this on their podcast last week. Where, and I don't know if you heard it, but they were talking about online activism and how they were actually really afraid to say that we're going, like they went to the Women's March, but they didn't say they were going to the Women's March because of the amount of hatred that they get online.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel like you yourself might be in danger because of the things you say online or the people that attack you?
Well, I, you know, having been,
I know you're a big soldier, man. You're big and scary.
Oh, I know. I know. And it, you know, this thing started early for me. My dad used to tell me, no son of mine would be gay. I'd shoot him first every single day of my life.
Wow.
Nobody want you, on and on. So, I mean, I got rid of fear in my life over a lot of things really early in life. But I consider it every single time I post stuff. And I've just decided that if that's what ends my life, then, you know, I'm trying to reach an audience that is notoriously difficult to reach. And they're people like me who have been through hell. And there just doesn't seem to be that much hope and everything. And I'm like, you know what? If not being a Christian or anything, I'm like, you know what? If Jesus could do it, then so can I. I think about it on some of my posts and stuff. And I get about probably 10 to 12 pieces of hate mail every day. Which is one of the reasons I avoid my DMs like the plague. Some of them are even crafty, you know, like the first two lines or so will be like, nice, nice, nice. And then you'll click on it and it's just like condensed, purified hate. Wow. And so I think that people should be careful. And if I had a cause, I don't think that I would put it up on Twitter. Or I would start a private group and I would just add some very trusted people, you know, and say, you know, we need to get the word out or something, but something pointed, you know, a few bullet points. And this will be our safe place. This will be the place where we're going to reconnoiter. If something goes wrong, we'll meet here. And we'll wait until 7 a.m, you know, whatever it takes, we'll all meet here. And anybody who doesn't, then we'll assume the worst and start looking for you, you know, jails or whatever. But I think that this is one of the things that pisses me off the most about this whole male-female divide thing. It's like women have to be careful. There are predators out there who are men. They're horrible predators. My fucking father. And I've met others, you know, and I've blocked several on Twitter. They're just ultra predators. And they don't have that part of the brain where they ever question what they do. They don't have ethics. So I think like a women's march and stuff like that, I think it's much better. This is one of those places where encryption and private groups and things like that are really a better choice. Because honestly, you can post something now online and in this political climate in the U.S. for certain, you know, you can have the freaking Proud Boys show up. And I'm honestly, that's not something that you really want. And I think advertising ahead of time is not a good idea with some of this stuff. So, did I get that question?
Yeah, no, that's perfect. Okay. That's perfect.
It's something that pisses me off. You know, you would think that women and a woman's space would be respected and everything, but it's just not. Gay space isn't respected. Women's space isn't respected. Black Americans, you know, space not respected at all. You know, I try to tread really gently on these things. I mean, I understand what it's like to have people telling me what I should and shouldn't be doing. And, well, if you just blah, 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 this wouldn't be a big deal. It's like, thank you, Captain Obvious.
That's my favorite. If you just did things my way. And right? I spent probably 30 years doing things other people's way. And, I mean, everybody knows my story. I was abused by white supremacists. I didn't tell anybody because I was afraid for my life. I was afraid for the life of my family members. And when I finally came forward, everyone was like, well, we believe you believe it happened, which is not the same thing. Yeah. Yesterday, a story came out about one of my rapists, and it turns out he had victims here.
Yeah.
When I said he had victims here.
Yeah.
And it was like this moment of validation. Like, I fucking told you.
Yeah.
I'm not crazy. All of you people who have gaslit me. And that part is so frustrating because when we say, like my mom said to me, I don't care if you talk about it, but why do you have to post it? And I'm like, because that's how I talk about it. Like, right. That's how I get it out. That's how I communicate with other people. That's how I've learned how, and for a lot of people, I feel like social media is how we as victims and survivors have learned to become survivors. that's where the game changed for me, was talking to Michelle Guido, talking to Profane Feminist, talking to people like yourself, and learning from your experiences that this is what had happened to me. And I had said to Vasia, I didn't know until last year how to say I was a victim of childhood sexual trafficking.
Yeah.
Those words as a full sentence, I didn't know how to say.
Impossible to say at first.
Completely. Impossible. Yeah. Because it's not a sentence. Like, I could say it about other people. This person has been. But to translate that so that it was Devin saying,
yeah,
I had, was really difficult. And yeah, I feel like social media is how so many of us connect and how we share our stories. And when we have those spaces invaded by people that are saying you should do things this way or you should do things that way, it tends to make us go quiet, and it cuts off that ability to start sharing how we really feel.
It's a form of abuse. You know, it really is. When they come across like that and invade a space and try to take it over with what they would do, I'm sorry, but that's a form of abuse. So.
Oh, I agree.
On the subject of white supremacists, my dad was a Montana survivalist, which is a really nice way to say white supremacist. Oh, and I was groomed early on, and I just never could buy in. And I was lent out to them over in northern Idaho. You know, they were working on their houses and this and that out in the woods at the end of the roads. And I met one, and he tried to hand me the literature and stuff, and it seemed like he was just going through the procedure. And then I said, no, that's not for me. And he's like, so you have questions? And I'm like, yes, I have questions. He's like, never stop asking your questions. And wow. It was the most powerful moment. I realized I was on the right track, and I just redoubled my efforts at that point. So when the abuse that is meted out by white supremacists is a lot deeper than just than people would think, you know, because they're very dogmatic and it's semi-religious, and they're fervent and they're zealots, and it comes with danger from the other people around them. And, you know, you never know who you're going to be picked out by and stuff. And that's one of the things, you know, I speak in code to some of these. That's why I have a pinned post on mine. It's like, listen, motherfuckers, this is me and you're not coming here. You know, I am absolutely against all forms of racism. And, I have that post, and several have showed up. Three or four have shown up and tried me and tested me, and then ended up backing off and leaving me alone. And then I block them when I'm all done with them. But I'm just really proud of you that you're talking about this, because this shit is hard.
It's not easy. That's for damn sure. No, and I'm sober right now. I'm going to smoke a joint when this is over. But to that end, Kamau Bell, have you seen his show?
No, I'm really clueless about all of these things. I'm sorry.
Okay, so he does this amazing show every Sunday night on CNN called United Shades of America, and it's always different topics. And the very first one he ever did, he went and, as a black man, met with genuine, full-blown white supremacists, met the white dragon or whatever the hell they call themselves, and sat down with them and had a conversation with them. And then he did it again this year, for this season, and several of them have come out and said, you know, I was a white supremacist for 30 or 40 years. I'm not anymore. I've changed my ways. I believe in this, that, other thing. And I posted, I will never, ever, ever, ever trust anybody who is a white supremacist.
Right.
I can't do it.
No, because you don't know if they've gone deep cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That mentality of the world is against me because I'm a white man is so deeply ingrained that I would never be able to trust that there's not still some part of that in them.
Well, I mean, until they learn how to take an inventory and do something like a 12-step program to get over it, I mean, it's an addiction to fear and control. You know, until they do something like a 12-step program, I mean, all I could ever say, the best I could ever say about a white supremacist is like, well, he's in recovery. That's the best thing I can say. My dad never recovered. My dad died a complete, utter white supremacist asshole right to the end. And, you know, all of his friends who are white supremacists all know who I am. Their sons know who I am. Their daughters know who I am. You know, so when I do post things, you know, I'm very conscious of what I'm doing and who the other audience is. And something that people don't understand, you know, I didn't write that post for the people who aren't white supremacists. I wrote that for the white supremacists.
Wow.
I don't trust them. I'll never trust them. And they're so slippery morally, you know, they have such flexible moralities. They have no internal ethics that, there's just no way I could ever trust them. I'm glad that you say that because it's an important point.
I'm a black woman. It's really hard for me to say that I'd ever, you know what I mean? And kudos to Kamau because he's given them the opportunity to share their story and share their experience. And I think that every single story on this planet matters. That's why I'm doing these podcasts. It's not so I can get famous. It's so I can have real conversations with real people.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I feel like there's just certain things that you can't excuse. And I really worry about, like, would I let a white supremacist or a reformed white supremacist around my children? No.
No.
Not given my experience having been abused by genuine Nazis. No, that's
I would never have to happen. I would have to see years of them learning new coping skills and mindfulness and actually being in recovery. I mean, would I ever trust another alcoholic? No. You know?
No.
No. So I learned the hard way.
To that end, what are some of the coping skills that you have learned that have helped you when you, like we were talking earlier about, and Vestia talked about this too, recognizing when you're about to have a panic attack or recognizing the symptoms of feeling anxious? How are some of the ways that you've learned to recognize that so you can get right with it before it happens?
So the very first...
Easy questions, the whole conversation.
Right. The very first meditation that I learned, I shortened it, and it was that whole body one, the whole body check-in where you feel all your feels. And what am I feeling and where am I feeling it? That was my very first coping skill, and that's where I realized I was having anxiety. My very next one was a 3-second rule. Before I respond to anything, I count to three, and I remap everything. It's like, what is my outcome? What is my preferred outcome in this conversation? Where am I going? Because sometimes you get triggered and then what comes out of your mouth is like,
yeah,
Wookie smash. And so I have a 3-second rule where I say, what is my outcome, desired outcome? And those are basically just different forms of what I have been calling mindfulness online. And so I learned mindfulness, I don't know, 6-ish or 7 years ago. And I realized the first two times it was like, what the hell is this? This is stupid. And so I took it a third time. My doctor, my PTSD counselor was like, no, you need this, dude. So I took it and I dove in. And then I realized that it was actually the most powerful part because it's like the beginning of every meditation. It's like, okay, my breathing, I'm just going to focus. I'm going to clear my mind. Anything that comes out of my mind, I'm like, yes, I see you. I'll let you go. And I'm back to breathing again. Another thought. Breathing. I just feel the breath of my nose right at the tip of my nose. Let it go. And it turned out to be powerful because I could clear my mind or I could take one of those little thoughts, those random thoughts that flies out and say, wait a minute, where the hell did you come from? And what are you? You know, so it's become a scalpel for me. I can dive in or I can just clear myself. So mindfulness actually set the stage for me to be able to pay attention to myself and my body, my brain. And I do it about every third breath. I've been doing it while we're talking, you know, like, and I do it a lot and people are like, why are you sighing? I'm like, I was not sighing. I was breathing. Damn it. And then on top of that, I learned CBT skills and then DBT skills, which is a superset of CBT. DBT was developed more for people with personality, emotional issues. CBT is much more clean cut. You know, this is how you figure out an alternate thought. This, you know, find an alternate view to what you're thinking. So those are my skills. And since then, I've taken them apart and I've made all these other tools. I have an emotional sawzall, an emotional table saw, an emotional drill, and screwdrivers. Because, I mean, I wish I had an emotional sonic screwdriver. That would be tasty. But so really, for me now, it's mindfulness, my 3-second rule. And then I have a couple components of CBT and DBT where I find alternate thoughts. And my 3-second rule comes in handy for finding alternate thoughts. I'm like, oh, what is my desired outcome? And honestly, with that, I've been able to manage as it's taken, I'm up to 6 years now, and it's practice every day, all day. And I've really come a long way. My sister noticed some time ago that I had become very angry, She was afraid for me. And I mean, that's just not me. And I was untreated bipolar disorder, untreated borderline personality disorder, and untreated anxiety. And I was on clonazepam at the time. So things were very messy.
Okay.
And I stopped the clonazepam cold turkey, which was a really bad move. But I was told my dog, I'm never going back. F that. And so I dove in. After that, I dove in on those, specifically mindfulness. And day in and day out, my most powerful tool is mindfulness. It's like, you're not real. You're just a thought in my head, and now you're going away, and I'm going right back to my breathing again. And sometimes it can be a little heavy, you know, in the middle of a depression or in the middle of a huge anxiety attack, because my heart rate will go over 200 very quickly. If it gets up to 150 and stays there for a few seconds too long, it's going to 200. Boom. And at that point, you know, your brain is like, I'm dying. And, you know, mindfulness becomes very difficult. And for those times, I use hydroxyzine. It's an antihistamine.
Okay.
And it buys me enough time. It slows things down enough that my mindfulness actually works. So day in and day out, I swear by mindfulness. For conversations and stuff, figuring out when I get triggered. And God, triggers are so ridiculous. They make no sense.
Triggers suck.
Yeah. You know, you're reading something, and next thing you know, your hands are shaking, and you're going to respond and fix the world. Rah. And for those, you know, my 3-second rule, and then I dive into, like, DBT skills. So does that answer the question?
No, it does, totally. Okay. I do the same thing. I started, and I've talked about this before, too. It started about 3 years ago when I got arrested. I sat down on my balcony, I started smoking weed, and I did not stop for 3 months. And I was like, I just need to be aware. I need to be in this moment where I'm focusing on how I'm thinking and how I'm feeling and what I'm whatever. And the next thing that I started doing, which I found interesting because I don't dance, is I started dancing around my house. And it was just a way of expelling all of that negative energy that I'd been holding on to without communicating it, because I still didn't have the words to say. Mm-hmm. I was raped by a Nazi. And so dancing really got that energy out, and it made it easier for me to sit down and really write and focus. And once I started writing, like, I haven't stopped since. And people will ask me, like, well, what about a boyfriend? Or don't you want to? I'm like, no, I'm happy. I'm sitting here, I'm writing, I'm building my brand. I'm doing the things that I put off doing for 25 years. Because I was busy not being mindful of what I needed and wanted. And so for me, writing is a meditation. I dance in the shower sometimes. I will get up after smoking a joint, go lay down, close my eyes, and just decompress. Like, whatever it takes to get me out of that negative space.
Yeah. Well, dancing is powerful. It's multi-expression. I don't even know how to explain it. So
I feel like everybody should dance naked at least once in their lives.
I dance in the kitchen on my most stressful days. I turn up certain songs, and I call them the Husky dance songs, and I dance with the Huskies. So
it works. It absolutely works.
Yeah, absolutely.
So how can people find you on social media?
The only place I have email, which I ignore dutifully. And I have Twitter. I have a domain I'm working on where I'm starting to put up some of my writing and some of the forms that I've altered. I mean, because some of these forms for like DBT skills and things are a little tedious. So I have a ogretrollhammer.com domain that I'm starting to build up now with content, but that's, you know, months out. If you want to find me on Twitter, I am at Wally Wookie, W-O-O-K-I-E. And that's really the only place I am. I got some brain injuries and stuff. I got to keep it simple. So Twitter is really Twitter is my full-time journal. If anybody wants to know where I am or what I'm doing or thinking, it's usually on Twitter. So,
and I'm Devin J. Hall. J. Hall at Devin J. Hall. And you can find me at loudmouthbrowngirl.com. Thanks for talking with me today.
Yeah. My email address, just in case though, is justwally@gmail.com. JustWally.
You know, you just gave out your email address.
I know. And they're going to get ignored for days before I find them. So
I'm not giving you my email address. Y'all have my website, my Twitter, my Facebook. You have my book, Instagram. That's all you get.
Honestly, I have email and Twitter, and that's it.
All right. Thank you, Wally.
Thank you so much. You're so awesome.
When you're ready to ride Metro, we want you to know we're ready for you. Here are just a few of the people at Metro to tell you how we're doing our part to keep riders safe.
We're cleaning like never before. We're hospital-grade cleaning.
You'll find hand sanitizer stations all over the Metro.
No mask, no Metro. Need one? We have a few extras.
At Metro, we're doing our part to keep the D.C. area moving. Find out more at WMATA.com/doingourpart.
You've counted down the seconds. Now make every second count for you. University of Maryland Global Campus will help you wave goodbye to 2020 and say hello to a new year where you take the next step in your education. Whether you want to study business, cybersecurity, healthcare, or IT, University of Maryland Global Campus can help. Apply by January 31st and we'll waive your application fee. Learn online. Visit umgc.edu. That's umgc.edu. Certified to operate in Virginia by CHEV.